everybody just settle in. We have a very interesting topic today. So we really want to be as receptive as we can be. So just pay attention to the breath, which brings us into the center of ourselves. The more completely we can be present in this room for these hours, the more deeply wisdom and understanding will come to us. So let's pray to the Masters to guide and inspire us, that for each one of us, the next step in awareness will be given to us. Heavenly Father,
Amen.
Divine Mother,
Divine.
Friend, beloved God,
Amen.
Jesus Christ,
Jesus.
Babaji Krishna,
Babaji Krishna.
Lahiri Mahashaya,
Lahiri Mahashaya.
Swami Sri Yukteswar, Paramhansa Yogananda, saints of all religions, humbly we bow to all. Guide us, that we may be receptive to expanding awareness, to deeper love, to more profound wisdom, that everything we do be inspired by your divine presence within. Meditate now for just a few minutes. And offer a prayer that individually and collectively we be guided and inspired by God and Gurus. Om peace.
It goes tick, tick.
Finding it outside their door when I
come to teach. Hello.
Hi.
Nice to see you.
Hi.
Remind me of your name.
It's Shannon.
Shannon. Okay. Okay, everyone. Today our topic is the chakras, which is really just endlessly fascinating. So, some of you I know well, and some I don't. So I would appreciate, if you don't mind starting, just telling me what your friend is, you know, spiritually speaking, what, if you don't mind.
I'm from southern part of India, and I've been living in the United States for 15 years now, and most part of it is in Bay Area. Like 5 years ago, I guess, like I got actively involved with the Northern Art of Living, where they teach breathing, meditation, yoga. And it really worked for me, practicing for like a couple of years. So from there onwards, like wherever there is any, like I've been to Shivananda Yoga Farm in Grasberg, for the retreat, and this study in Sinitas, Paramahansa Yoga Meditation Center. And today evening I went to a church for the Christmas thing, and then I go to temples to chant. So it's something that fascinates me. So I'm trying to seek as much as I can and learn and grow from there.
Very good. Is Art of Living also in the Bay Area?
Or yeah. Accessibility was one thing with them, I guess, like there are several centers across. You know.
I know they're gigantic in India, but of course it would be big here because there's so many Indians here. Why not?
Yeah, it is big actually. The breathing, when someone said like breathing cleanses the nervous system, I was like, what are these people talking about, right? Uh-huh. I run and I breathe, I walk and I breathe. Exercise also, it resists me, but then it was different time practice over a period of time. I think the end point is meditation. The goal is meditation. But to reach, we have different paths, I guess. So,
certainly.
Whatever works for us.
Whatever's doing, as someone once put it very simply, there are real enemies to religious life on the planet right now, and it's not each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just anybody who's trying to live more for God as a friend and an ally at this point. Yeah. I was, I'll just tell you this briefly, but I accepted an invitation years ago, but for some reason it seemed like a good idea. The woman absolutely kept calling me, so I said yes, and I went to speak at the Atheist Association meeting in Santa Clara. It was a really bad idea. And I was on this panel with an Episcopal priest and myself, and it seems like there was a couple others, and then there was a very fundamentalist, Bible-based, born-again guy. And then there were all these satanic people in the room. I mean, it was really dark. The state president of the Atheist Society was like a caricature from like it would be like a comedy documentary to put this guy in that role. All in black, dyed black hair, sleazy man. I mean, he was terrible. And the Episcopal guy was trying to be real open-minded. And he was almost as bad. He was just trying to accept everything. And the fundamentalist guy and I, we just kept huddling together. You know? It was like the two of us somehow could feel the energy in the room, and seemingly other people couldn't. And I sort of remember whispering to him, in other circumstances, we would not be on the same side. You know, he would have considered me to be an enemy of sorts. But in that setting, it was so clear what the real forces of darkness were, which was, I mean, you don't have to be religious, which was just this selfish materialism is what I would call it. Especially that man who was in charge. He was just like, if I can get what I want, why would I not take it? That was kind of his attitude. Because if there's no higher value, if I'm not related to anything, if death is the end of everything, who cares? If I want it and I can get it, why wouldn't I take it? And, you know, all the rest is just pasted on top. But this other man and I, we could both just see that this is the real dark force.
Yeah.
And yeah, even this Episcopal man's willingness to act as if that was just a perfectly equal choice. It was a very weird experience. But anyway, yes, many paths to the same goal. Even that witch-like man who was in charge. He too, someday. Yes, Vicky.
And I have been on the Kriya Yoga path for, I guess, like 13 years through a slightly different sort of path. But I'm very happy to be at Ananda now.
Mm-hmm. And we're happy you found us.
Yes.
Works for all of us.
Yeah.
And
I'm Shannon, from the Seattle area. Came down here to do a program at Stanford and somehow just stay. I was raised Catholic. I'm one of the few people who would feel fortunate for that. I'm not a practicing Catholic. I think it, like humanity, has both extremes. But I had some really, really fortunate divine foundation and experience there, even though it's not what I choose to practice now. And came to Ananda first for a meditation class. And really, you know, I think when you go to a service, you can feel the energy here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something I want as a part of my life.
Excellent. Very good. Anne-Marie.
My name is Anne-Marie. I moved here almost a year and a half ago from Los Angeles. I attended the Self-Realization Center there. Seeking to see if I could quiet my mind enough to learn how to meditate and breathe. And after going through a horrible divorce, I left Los Angeles and came here. And I actually found out about Ananda through a woman who gave me my facial. She was telling me about Ananda, and I started visiting here.
What's her name?
Karen Ditson.
Yes,
and
every so often people come in and say, the woman who gave me my facial. I presume it's the same woman.
Actually, she's going to be moving to Australia in a couple of months.
Her husband? Oh, really?
Yes,
that's a good
one.
Okay.
Uh-huh. But, so anyways, and I actually signed up on October 23 of next year to go on a 21-day pilgrimage to India.
Oh, wonderful.
I love it. Yes, I'm very excited.
Love it.
But I'm
Very good. Welcome. So how long did you attend SRF in LA?
For about a year and a half.
So it's still all, relatively speaking, new.
Yes.
Not entirely new, but relatively. Yes. Did you progress through their lessons to take Kriya or anything like that yet?
I did not.
There's no reason why you should. I was only just asking. I just wanted to know what the assumptions in the room are. Very good. Well, I'm very happy for that. And certainly having your personal life blown apart is a powerful incentive.
Yes.
To find something to hold on to.
Yes, thank you.
It's no joke.
Yeah.
God has mysterious, unkind ways at times that in the end always work out, but the middle is not fun.
Yes, thank you.
Jan.
And I'm Jan.
You all just went on the same trip Anne Marie's about to go on.
I know, that's why.
Oh, really?
We did it a couple of years ago.
And earlier years than that, I used to lead that trip.
Yeah.
That was a long time
ago. Okay. Here you're not going.
I would love to go. I actually even think of it sometimes, but not yet. But I can certainly say it's a fantastic, life-changing journey. Yes.
And I keep looking at Joe, Tish, and Davey and all the spots they've been visiting online and just getting all that energy back from all those fabulous places. I'm Jan, and this is my home.
It has been for a while.
Yeah, it has been for a while. Not that long, long enough. And I was raised a Catholic, and I always felt there was something a little not settling with it. I was always a very devout Catholic, but it just didn't harmonize with me. And then I found it now and then that all came together. Be a part and help and do
save. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Art?
My name's Art, and Jen and I are married. And we do most of our Ananda trips together, and we really enjoy the pilgrimage to India, and we've been down to Southern California too, and in the Yogananda's sites, and spend time in Encinitas when we go visit our daughter. So it's really invigorating and inspirational to know that we have an event coming up that we could go in and meditate and enjoy the spiritual power that comes from it. Been members of Ananda maybe 4+ years now, and I was raised Catholic and got the fundamentals as the Jesuits taught it. Always felt that there was something they weren't being honest about or telling us the whole story. And when Jan and I started coming to the services and listened to Asha speak on Sunday in her sermons, we'd be in the car on the way home saying, yeah, that's it. So we would compare notes. And for about 2 months, we would alternate. One Sunday we'd go to the Catholic Church, the other Sunday we'd come to Ananda, and then one day we said, that's it. we know where the truth is. And we've been really enjoying it in that sense ever since. Taking a lot of classes, through the Kriya Bond, and enjoy Asha's Tuesday night classes too. Every time we see something that seems to be of interest or we want to get reinforced, that's why we're here today.
Okay, excellent. Let me just think, find what I was going to say. I had a thought there, but I lost it, so I'll just have to go and so it comes back into my head. I knew what I was going to say. It was about the Jesuits giving it the way they understood it. I remember when I was a child, and some of you have heard me say this, so forgive me for repeating. I always felt there had to be a deeper meaning to life. And being a child, and I had good parents, and I respect them. They were intelligent and respectful of me. And I just assumed that they knew more than they were telling me. and that I was just too young, and that sooner or later they would tell me. And I remember how really freaky it was when I realized that they didn't know. And that they weren't holding back, that they were giving me the entire story as they understood it. And it was just everything that they knew. What was even more surprising to me is that they weren't completely freaked out about that. Because I was freaked out about it in my childlike way. I mean, I was just totally discombobulated because there was no thread, no unifying thread to my life experience, and nobody was talking to me about the big picture. They were just talking about the little parts of it, and the little parts just weren't going to work unless I could see a big picture, and nobody knew it. And I went all the way through for my first year of college thinking finally that at college they would know, and they didn't. And so I lasted 1 year. I really lasted about 2 weeks, but I didn't drop out until after the end of the first year. But then very shortly after that, I was introduced to the principles of self-realization. And not as religion, but as principles of this is the way that we're made, and in as much as this is the way we're made, if you want your experience of life to have meaning and be more joy-filled, this is the way we're made, and this is what will work. And it was such a self-evident question to ask and answer that I was just astonished that nobody had ever brought it up before. But it came to me through the teachings of India, which that would have been 1966. So it was newer for that to be starting. Nowadays, you can just turn around and you see lots of places people are talking to, but that was 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's really quite a long time in our society and in one person's life. And so what happened to me over time, about 4 years later, 3 years later, 3 years later, I met Swami Kriyananda, who's the founder of Ananda, and that really crystallized and gave an absolute focus from which I've never wavered for my exploration of this is how we're made and this is what you want to do about it. So I of a disciple of a certain path and the teachings that I know, I say I'm extremely highly educated in a very narrow way because I've never really gone much beyond this particular path, but I've dedicated every ounce of my energy to it. And it being seminal in nature, standing from, because the essential basis of this path is self-realization itself, of which all religions, Judaism, Christianity, Catholicism, everything emanates from this base, because all true masters come from the same place. Jesus being a self-realized master, his revelation was the same as Yogananda's or Krishna's or anyone's. Afterwards, the Jesuits and everybody else start communicating it as it looks to them. And so that, it's just, if you're halfway up the mountain and the peak is covered in fog, you don't know what the peak looks like and you describe where you're standing. And it's not, it only becomes false if you describe where you're standing as the peak of the mountain. And that's where confusion sets in. To merely stand halfway up the mountain and describe what it looks like is in itself harmless. It's when you declare that there is no top to the mountain and where I'm standing is the peak. That's when all the trouble starts. But we don't have to worry about that because we're not caught in that. So today, over the course of these now many years of studying and trying to live by these principles, there are certain key ideas that to my way of thinking, actually give you almost like a generic map. And that if you can get certain of these principles clear in our awareness, then we find that many other strings can be pulled out in a straight line if these fundamental ideas are in order. Karma, reincarnation, and the chakras are probably three of the main ones. If we can understand how those all work. And karma and reincarnation are objective truths that are verified by the masters and thanks to the internet, we have all this increasing evidence of children remembering their past lives, of people remembering their past lives, and evidence for it. And the chakras is the metaphysics of how karma reincarnation work. And the reason karma reincarnation and then the additional fact of the chakras are so important is because it answers really, really basic questions like, what am I doing here? And what is the point of being here? And do my experiences is there any consistent plan to my experiences? Am I just sort of randomly being boinged around the planet, or is there something behind this? And if there is something behind this, how can I cooperate with it instead of always being out of sync with it? And these were the questions as a child that I was asking. You know, I had this extremely intense sense of myself. I don't know how else to put it. I was comparing notes with different people. I had a very extremely pleasant and positive upbringing, so I didn't have to fight against a lot of things. But there were people we were talking once about being coerced by other people's ideas. And I commented about the fact that I always had so much confidence in my own concept of things that if somebody told me something that I didn't agree with, I just dismissed it without a second thought, and to a fault, because I could have learned a lot from other people that I just didn't bother to learn from. But everybody's vices are their virtues taken too far. And my virtue is this very strong belief in my own experience. And my vice is that even when I'm wrong, I still believe in myself. And that's unfortunate. So everything, you know, works in one way or another. But when I encountered these principles, and I know some of you are familiar with all the words and some of you aren't, so I'll just... there's a word in Sanskrit which is Sanatan Dharma. And Swami Kriyananda has never asked us to learn Sanskrit or learn to pronounce things perfectly and so on, just because he said it's just not worth it. Ananda itself is not really pronounced Ananda, it's pronounced Ananda or something like that. An Indian Swami said to Kriyananda, why do you let them pronounce it so badly? He said, because if I tried to get them to say it right, I would do nothing else for the rest of my life. So Sanatan Dharma is a Sanskrit phrase. So we use Sanskrit words when there simply is no Indian English equivalent. Because English-speaking people have not been interested in subtle states of consciousness. So we didn't develop language for it. And English being such an egalitarian language, it just takes in whatever words it finds and calls them English after a while. Karma, guru, all of these words are now just English. So Sanatan Dharma will be someday. And it means really simply eternal truth. And this is, I'm not offering this, because I was speaking against dogmatic religion. I'm not offering this as dogmatic religion, even though it may sound like that. We just have to take me at my word on this. This is, the tradition of India is the ancient, continuous tradition of spiritual understanding. It's the role of India has always been to be the guru of the planet, which is why many of us born in the West have this incredible sense of, I guess the word is nostalgia. And the first time I went to India, which was in 1986, as one of my friends said, I don't mind living the rest of my life in America now that I know there's a culture to which I belong. There was just a feeling that this is my true culture, not India, especially as it was in 86. Now it's all becoming so westernized.
Yeah.
But the principles behind it. And Sanatan Dharma is one of those principles. It translates as eternal truth, or even nicer, that which is. And all of the masters of whatever persuasion they eventually became identified with have certain revelations, and those revelations are perceptions. They're not ideas. They're just an actual experience of that which is. And then they come back meaning from whatever that perception is, or come back reincarnate on the planet. And they have a group of disciples, they have a culture, they have a mission that they have to carry out, and they take the eternal truth and they try to say it in a way that this particular group can accept and go forward. Jesus, ironically, considering how history has dealt with it, was born, was the avatar, he was the incarnation for the Jewish people. He was a Jewish rabbi. Almost all of his followers were Jews. The whole controversy was within Judaism. It wasn't really between the Jews and, because there was no and. They were just all Jews. And they had a big internal argument, because Jesus came to say to the priests, you have corrupted the true teaching of Moses, and I'm here to give you the right, to put it on the right footing again. Because a corrupt priesthood had taken control of Judaism. And Judaism is a true, was a sanat in dharma, it's based on the eternal truth. But the corrupt priesthood, it was a power struggle like any other, did not want to be unseated by this upstart. And so they manipulated things to get rid of him. But unfortunately, he was speaking eternal truth, and truth just doesn't go away just because it's contrary to somebody's self-interest. Truth stands on its own forever. That's what this is about. So when Yogananda came to America in 1920, he was commissioned by this line of gurus, including Jesus, to bring back to the West the message of Sanatana Dharma, to explain again the eternal truth, which Jesus had taught exactly, but which churchianity had wandered away from Christianity, just like the synagogues have wandered away from true Judaism, the Hindus have wandered away from Sanatana Dharma. In India, there's still a more of an understanding of Sanatana Dharma, but Hinduism is not Sanatana Dharma. It's rituals and priests and traditions and mythologies. And one of my Indian friends said, Hinduism is the only religion that is so complicated you have to pay someone to practice it for you, which is you have to hire a priest to do your ceremony for you because you don't know how to do it anymore. In other words, you have no direct access, according to Hinduism, not according to Sanatana Dharma, but according to Hinduism, which is, makes it no different than Catholicism, where unless you get the particular blessing from the priest at the end of your life, then you're condemned, or fundamentalism, or unless you believe the Bible, or I don't exactly know what the particular delusions of Judaism are, even though I was raised in it. One among the delusions of Judaism is that there is such a thing as a Jewish soul, and then if you're Jewish, once you're Jewish forever, which is an interesting concept, which is not true, but there it is. And it's just everything has its way. So the principles of Sanatana Dharma, eternal truth, which is really just describing that which is directly perceived by those whose consciousness has expanded sufficiently that they can, from the top of the mountain, see what the whole story is, and then put into systematic form. And this is where these principles, I'll just work with these three today, karma, reincarnation, and the chakra system, which helps make it happen, fit in. Because what they answer is the questions that we are always asking, which is, who am I? Why am I here? What really causes me suffering? And then the corollary of that, what will bring me true happiness? And especially those last two questions, every single decision that any one of us have ever made, even from childhood, has always been based on the idea that this will bring me happiness or this will alleviate my suffering. And if one is honest enough and just looks through and just gets rid of all the details, no matter what it might be, we're always making that decision. You referred to the two little four-year-old girls and having a tough morning. So some four-year-old child has decided what is needed for her happiness at this particular point. Valid or otherwise, it doesn't really matter because that's the point of view that she's holding. And if you're going to be a good parent to her, you might try to expand her understanding and coax her, but she's only ever going to make her decision based on her actual perception. And it may be that my perception of my greatest happiness is to allow myself to be dominated by my mother. but that still the decision is made because I'll suffer less if I allow myself to be dominated. Then, and maybe, and even more wisely, I'll trust my mother that she knows. And even though I may not agree, I'm going to trust that she knows, because that's where my greater happiness lies. And then, of course, you may find later that it was cowardice that caused you to trust, or fear that caused you to trust, and you realize that my happiness didn't really come from that action. But in my greater praise, it seemed like a good idea at the time. Right? So, when we can get karma reincarnation in the chakra system in place, we can start answering that question, what causes suffering? What brings happiness? Who am I really? And what can I do about that? Okay? So, any questions or comments before we move forward from there? Okay. So, if we pay attention to life more than just superficially, and one of the great difficulties that we have is that our memories are very short and our sense of the relationship of one thing to another is not always really great. We tend to get lost in the moment and then we don't remember. Either we're afraid to take responsibility or we're not conscious enough to recognize where our true responsibility lies. So this is complicated by the fact that many of the causes of our present existence actually began in incarnations we don't remember. But putting that aside for a moment, many of the causes of the suffering we have now are caused by things in this lifetime that we don't remember. And a part of that might be subconscious conditioning from when we were children. But it can also just be a complete obliviousness, for example, to the effect of certain of our attitudes on the people who are around us. There was a woman friend of mine who, very nice woman, but quite emotional. And she was having a great deal of difficulty in a marriage that she was in, which was an unsuitable marriage and eventually fell apart anyway. But she was sort of talking to me, and I was trying to support her, even though I was conscious of her culpability in the disharmony in her household. And she said that she had sort of an emotional reaction, and I'd also heard it from his side. She'd had a certain emotional reaction. I said, oh, I said, you know, how emotional? I'll say, like on a scale of 1 to 10, like how emotional? She said really quietly, 10. I think it would have been about 19, actually. But even that was like so reluctant to realize the impact of hitting 10 with her emotions on a regular basis, the impact that was having on the man she was living with. And it wasn't like she was evil or anything like that. She just was not aware. And so his gradual losing interest in trying to make the relationship work was a mystery to her. Standing on the outside of it, it wasn't a mystery to me, because he was not constituted to live with that kind of emotion. And she was so constituted, as to her that seemed perfectly normal. I knew another couple that were international. He was Latin, and she was from the British Isles. And after it all fell apart, she said, I told him that I was very upset. He said, but she wasn't throwing any dishes. How did I know? It's just, there we are. So we don't remember. But if we're paying attention, we recognize that everything in life is interrelated. It's really a seamless tapestry. It's an eternal and fascinating seamless tapestry where the picture we're looking at now has threads that come from here and that go on to here, and this is all that we're seeing. In the years that I lived with Swami Kriyananda, which was most of my adult life, I lived in close association with him, not in the same house. He often perceived things very differently than I did. And at the beginning, and because of my vice and virtue of having a lot of confidence in my own perception, and because of his marvelously sensitive way of working with me, which was to respect me more than I deserved. I often, you know, I was able to stand up and communicate my point of view. I never felt like I couldn't. And often I didn't understand or I would challenge what he had to say. But fortunately, over time, I gradually began to realize something really simple. I wasn't always wrong. Sometimes I was, but I wasn't always wrong. But it was like on a movie, you see, I was involved in the making of a movie. We made a movie about Ananda, and I was involved in it, and I'd never been involved in movie making, and it's a fascinating project because this is what appears in front of the camera. And an inch away from it, on either side, all of these other extremely fascinating and utterly unrelated things are going on in order for this much to happen on the screen. And I hadn't had that experience, but it was so clear when I saw it. With Swamiji, it would be like I would reason something out from the edge of my frame to what was going on to where I thought it was going off the frame, and I wasn't always wrong, that there was a consistent something I could perceive. But he had no frame. And what crossed our vision at this point had an origin point so much earlier and so different that it had a completely different trajectory for him, a completely different cause and a completely different destiny. So naturally, the decisions that he might make here were entirely different than mine that was working just like this. And I gradually, by listening and watching, I really began to realize, you know, how big the frame is. And so the principle of karma is a really simple one. Karma is the law of cause and effect. That's all. That things have causes, and then they have effects. But the cause and effect might not be what we see, but that doesn't mean that it can't be consistently drawn. So then the question has to become, what is the purpose of human life? And we all have an answer to that question, and whether we are bold enough to articulate it, we act on it continuously. The purpose of human life is for me to enjoy myself, for me not to suffer, for me to be happy. And that's noble enough, but generally speaking, what we describe as happy is that things go according to the way I want them, and that nothing really intrudes and causes me too much trouble or too much challenge. The words that really describe it to my mind are very simple. We want ease and we want pleasure. We might not be terrible hedonists. You know, our pleasure might be a happy family, you know, having our children not get in any trouble, having my finances stay together, have somebody else elected president, whatever it might be. But if we find ease and if we find pleasure, we call that good. And most people work very hard to make their lives easy and pleasurable. You try to get a job you like, you try to get, you know, a spouse that you're compatible with, you try to live in an environment you like, you get your retirement set up, you pay off your mortgage, you know, so that everything will be easy and pleasurable. And you try to elect your officials, or you move out of the country where it's uncomfortable and you move to another one that you like. But it's all based on these two ideas. So the question is, actually, is a life of ease and pleasure really a successful life? And were we born for things to be easy and pleasurable? And a lot of people will say, well, yes, of course, self-evidently, and are even willing to put out energy to make this happen. But when we start thinking deeper, two things happen. One is, this is much harder to attain than we thought it was. We marry someone we have absolute faith in, they turn out to be a secret alcoholic, or they end up having an unbearable mother that they're more attached to than they're attached to you. You lovingly give birth to children, and then those children turn out to have complicated karmic destinies of their own that are not at all what you wanted. Or, as Yogananda said, sometimes we incarnate with our enemies so that we can, quote, fight it out at close quarters. And so instead of having this spontaneous loving relationship, we don't. One really interesting story that I knew firsthand was this woman gave birth to twins, a boy and a girl. She adored the boy, and from the very beginning she really did not like the daughter. The daughter and she were enemies from some past life. I mean, I knew the daughter. It was not an easy life for her, but it was just a fact. you know, they had been, in some previous incarnation, really antagonistic. And the mere fact that this was now her baby did not fundamentally change the utter incompatibility. Even if you don't have that behind it, you can just give birth to someone who has just a totally different way of relating to the world. This funny story that a friend of mine used to tell, he said there was this family in Texas, and they had three children, and they just had created a model family. And when the kids were teenagers, they were just sailing through the teen years, and the parents became, they began to give seminars on how to raise children and, you know, how to go through the teen years. And then they had an oops baby, like 15 years after the youngest one. And that child, as my friend put it, he said the child's first word was no, and the person's, the child's first complete sentence was, do it yourself. And it was just like all their rules of parenting, totally none of it worked because they had somebody else. They'd gotten three very cooperative people with whom they were completely in tune, and this fourth child was just a completely different person. And, you know, just some other complete system was required. And it really wasn't, had I had my system together, it's the person who's moved into your house. As Swami said, this complete stranger who you've invited in to take care of for the next 20 years. You never know. All right. But the fact is, when you're dealing with ease and pleasure, two things happen. One is very hard to sustain. And so when it is blown up, which it is invariably blown up, for one reason or another, if for no other reason, even when everything goes well, it's insufficient. And we learn from being disappointed. That Swamiji always said very sweetly, we learn more from being fulfilled. Because if we didn't get what we want, we always think, if I could have it, then I would be happy. So what really happens, and this is why there is more suicide among the wealthy than there is among the impoverished, is because you get everything you want, and you still realize that if I'm just looking for ease and pleasure, that's not how I mean. That is not Sanat and Dharma. Very simple. You know, it's not enough to have everything my ego desires just the way I want. So then the other question is, what might be the purpose of life if it isn't just ease and pleasure? Well, here's an interesting thing. If you think of children, you're talking about the four-year-olds that you know well. Do you have small children?
No.
Okay. No one else has small children. What's happening with those children is that they are gradually, and the word is, they are gradually expanding their awareness. It's a very sort of simple, non-dogmatic way to think about it. First, they don't even know their names. They don't know who's mommy. They don't know who's Uncle Bill. They don't know who's grandpa. Little tiny babies can be frightened when their own hands flash across their face because they have no control over their body, and all of a sudden this thing comes at them and they don't know where it comes from. There's a stage of development where a child discovers his own feet, and he's just so excited by his feet because they're such a marvelous plaything that are suddenly just like there with him all the time. And on a real level, it's an increase in awareness. Yogananda describes in his autobiography lying in his crib with all of these different languages going through his head from all of his different incarnations, and gradually beginning to notice that Bengali was the one they were speaking around him. And so he gradually began to respond in Bengali. He became aware of what the language was around him. I heard a very funny story from somebody was in the family, Berlitz is a family name, the Berlitz family from the Berlitz language school, mm-hmm. which used to be well known. He's born into the family, and he was being raised in five languages, mother, father, grandma, grandpa, and an aunt. They all spoke to the child in a different language so that he could simultaneously learn them all. When he was about four, he reasoned it out, and he observed that it seems like every individual had their own language. So he just started responding in his. And it took some time for them to sort it out, you know, get him to start talking back to them in theirs, because he reasoned it out. This is what's happening. Swami Kriyananda was born in Romania. He was raised in Romania. His father was a geologist for what was then Standard Oil Company. He lived in Romania. His parents were American. The group that they lived in were mostly English-speaking. His nurse was German. Let's see, there was another language. His nurse was German. It was just three languages. His nurse was German and spoke German to them. His parents spoke American, and Romanian was all around him, and his mother talked to the household help with Romanian, and so he talked to all the servants and so on in Romanian. Swami said at a certain point his German was better than his English because he just grew up that way. And then when he was 9, he learned French. I knew there were 4. But he said once his mother spoke to him in Romanian, and he said, "Mother, don't talk to me like you talk to the servants." That was just his perception. This is what Romanian is for. It's not for your family. It's for people who help you in the house. And he talked about how amazing it was when they first traveled to England. And he saw everybody speaking English. He just didn't know where to put that in the whole context. It's all an increase in awareness. Now, we also learn awareness. What are my talents? What are my skills? When I hit the little boy in the sandbox with my shovel, he doesn't want to play with me anymore, or he hits me back with his truck. We begin to find out that that kind of behavior brings certain results. Then we grow up and we learn awareness on many other levels. If I treat my children this way, this is how they're going to respond. If I have this expectation of life, this is what's going to happen. If I don't work hard at my job, I get fired. I got fired from this job before I came to Ananda, so I was about 21 or 22. I got fired. I had a job with this law firm. Must have been when I was 23. This law firm in San Francisco. And it was just before computers started, and they had some kind of a machine that was the beginning of an automatic typing machine. And for a law firm, that was an incredibly helpful thing. And I became knowledgeable about that, and I just sat in this little cubicle and I ran this machine. I didn't give a damn about the job or the company. I couldn't have cared less. I entirely went to work to get money, period, zero. Didn't even occur to me that I should care about the job. It just was like so far out of my thinking. I did my job very well because I was bright, but after on the 90th day of my 3-month trial period, the personnel director fired me. And she fired me because I didn't give a damn. And I found that as an amazing reason to be fired. And it was 10 years until I was well into Ananda and was working on something I really cared about. And I began to see that some people really cared and some people just worked. And I actually wrote her a letter and said, "Thank you for firing me. I really didn't understand until now." You know, I mean, that would be an obvious thing. But my awareness, I had to expand my awareness to understand other possibilities, what it meant to really give your heart to something, all kinds of things. Now, very often, an increase in awareness does not come without pain or effort. And pain and effort are quite the opposite of ease and pleasure, aren't they? So instead of pleasure, we have pain. Instead of ease, we have effort. But the result of suffering and effort is often that we have an increase in awareness. And when we get an increase in awareness, doesn't that change everything? You know, it's like always, almost always, when something really terrible happens to us, we didn't see it coming because we weren't aware. I mean, I'm just so impressed by how we don't see it coming. People around us see it coming, but we never see it coming. How many friends do you have when you wait? A dear friend of mine, when she married her second husband, I said, "Don't marry this man. This is a terrible idea. This is going to be a disastrous marriage." And it was. And at the end, she said, "Why didn't you tell me?" I said, "Honey, I did." In absolute plain English, I told you, "This is going to be a disaster. Don't do this." But she didn't even hear me. She literally did not know that I'd spoken. And I have a very clear memory. I knew I said it to her exactly without even mincing words. But she had to go through pain and effort in order to increase her awareness, to get over, in her case, her romantic view of life, her romanticizing of the people around her, to increase her awareness. Now, if we're honest, as a rule, after pain and effort, we're glad to have an increase in awareness, aren't we? Because awareness is everything.
So if the purpose of life is to increase in awareness, and most people are not inclined to do it if things are easy and pleasurable, then is it bad when things are painful and difficult? What are we doing here? So what, and then add to this the simple principle of karma, which is cause and effect, which is we have put out certain causes that are not really in keeping with Sanatan Dharma, and we're thinking that we're going to find an easy, pleasurable route by doing this, but in fact, that delusion has to be smashed to wake us up into something higher. And then you throw in the concept of reincarnation, which is to say that it takes more than one span to learn the lesson. And that's almost just commonsensical. Imagine, I think of Bernie Madoff as an example, because he was somebody who happened recently, who just behaved, he ruined so many people's lives. And even if he has to go to prison and his personal life falls apart, has he really learned? Does he really know? Can he just die and start over and nothing will happen? You know, and all of that karma, does it just dissolve? And if he'd gotten away with it and died with everything intact, would that have been good? So we find that it just takes longer. Often good people get to the end of their lives without the scales being balanced. And, bad people do, and often good people never seem to get their rewards. But if you just add in the idea that we don't start as a clean slate, and when we die we go on, then the whole picture changes. It also radically changes it for the individual. Because then all of a sudden it's like, there's no escape. I'll tell you one last thing, and then we'll move right into the chakras. There was a man named Stephen Levine. I don't know if he's still living, and he was one of the early pioneers of conscious dying back decades ago. Some of you are old enough to remember him. And he would give these seminars for people with terminal illnesses, and there was, I was interested in his work, but I never really dove into it. I was just impressed by it. But one of the things that he did for his seminars with people who had terminal diagnoses was that he would have people make two lists. And the first list would be all the things that you're grieving about because you're never going to get to experiencing them because your life is going to end sooner than you expect. I'll never see my grandchildren. I'll never walk my daughter down the aisle. You know, just whatever it might be. And of course, you know, that was incredibly emotional as everybody had to let go. And they would think that was really why they were there. The other list was all the things that you're happy because you're not going to have to deal with now. Which is actually not a small list. You know, I certainly am conscious of things that I'm old enough now to think that maybe I can just die and I'll never have to deal with these things. But actually, he said, when they start the work, it's the second list that you really have to deal with. Because, of course, that's what you're trying to not face. That's where you want to have to not go through the pain and the effort required to actually resolve all of this. Of course, grief is also an issue. Both of them count. But what was interesting, when I first read about that, I thought, that's so interesting. I really want to try that. But it was hard. Because I'm so steeped in Sanatan Dharma, because reincarnation is so real to me now in my life, there wasn't a lot I could put on that list because there was no such thing as getting away with it in my own thinking. In other words, what is the point? What is the point of hiding out? Because if the karma is there, the karma has to be faced. And it's always now. We imagine that there is a future, but there is no such thing as future, because when you're, you know, this was future yesterday. You know, a decade ago, this was future. When I was 20, this was future. But it isn't future, it's now. So whenever that karma has to be faced, it's going to be now, and it's going to require effort and suffering. So why not get it over with? So this is karma and reincarnation, how it plays out with Sanatan Dharma, which the purpose is increasing our awareness. The method is often effort and sometimes pain. And it is absolutely unavoidable. It's unavoidable for a peculiar yes-no reason. It's unavoidable because
our inner self will never be satisfied until we have triumphed over all suffering. Because this idea that it should be easy and pleasurable is true. We are made in the image of spirit, and our true nature is this word, Satchitananda, which is ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss. Satchitananda. Bliss, consciousness, eternity. Ever-new bliss. And that is who we really are. And every time we suffer, the reason we're so annoyed is because some part of us knows that it's not right. If, in fact, suffering were our true nature, why would we object? Because it was just the way it's what's supposed to happen, but we know it's not supposed to happen. We're just a little confused as to how to get there. So if we know that Satchitananda is where we're going, anything that takes it away from us is because we have a lack of awareness. I got divorced, somebody died, somebody betrayed me, my family is a disappointment to me, I'm alone, my career didn't work out. All of those things take us away from ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new joy, and we think, oh, I just need to restore them. But gradually our awareness increases and we realize, no, I need to redefine, re-experience myself so that nothing interferes. And the Sanatana Dharma is, that's it. That's what we're doing here, friends. Our destiny is the same as those masters. And it's eternal freedom and bliss. And anything less than that, we're going to have to increase our awareness until we find it. Okay? Questions, thoughts, or comments before we move into the next part of it? Yes, all right.
Is there a forgiveness or a shortcut through karma?
Mm-hmm.
Or is there an evaluation of what's really bad or really good? How does that fare with reincarnation? I mean, you could spend 500 lifetimes working out something that another person may not have. They did the same thing,
right.
Same action, the same consequence.
Right.
But their karma, for some reason, was shorter. Is that
yes. What you're saying is, and I'm going to hold that question. I'm going to answer partially, and then I'll explain it with the chakras because it'll be more clear. But the fact of the matter is, we can reincarnate literally millions of times and never really make a lot of progress. We just keep trying to restore ease and pleasure, and we just keep trying to find new ways to restore ease and pleasure. Eventually, which is a very weird word, eventually we come to full awareness. But how many millions of lifetimes that takes depends a lot on, it just depends on our particular, the intensity of our determination and our courage. I mean, we see people who are addicted to very unwholesome things, and even though that addiction is causing them great suffering, the effort to overcome it looks worse to them than the consequences of the addiction. We've all known alcoholics or sexaholics or drug addicts, and when I look at what they're doing, I think it's not worth it because I've been there. I've hit bottom in other lifetimes, and I realize the effort to overcome it is less painful than the continuation. But no one will make that change unless and until they know it for themselves. So you're absolutely correct.
Would each instance be related to the awareness that the individual has for that
Yes,
that
exactly.
500 lifetimes working out.
That's exactly right.
And somebody else might have conveyed the same offense, but their awareness and their concept is shorter.
And it's because of all the convoluted different pieces.
Okay.
And that, you know, this person who's not a drinker may be a sadist over here. Yeah, and this one who's a sadist, at least he doesn't smoke, you know. It's like people set it up in all different ways.
Uh-oh.
Oops, okay. Is it black tea or something else?
No, I think
the cap wasn't on.
That's all right. And it's just water or just whatever it is. I think we'll take a pause.
Okay.
Let's take just 10 minutes. Come back at 11:15.
Sure.
And that's all right. I was about to take a pause anyway. And we'll come back to what you asked for more in just a minute, as soon as we come back to the top. Just, by the way, I am recording this, and it's posted, it's supposed to be posted on the Ananda Palo Alto site soon after, so you don't have to worry about remembering. Also, if you go to my website, which is Asha Joy is my website, and it takes you to a YouTube channel where all of the talks that I have given and do give are posted, literally hundreds, and lots of different classes on the chakras, the karma, reincarnation. So if you're interested in anything that's said here, you can find it there. I hurt my arm about 3.5 weeks ago. It's almost okay. But I still have this awful grimace, so forgive me
when I do.
On the bicycle accident?
I fell off my bike.
You did?
It was not. It was a completely airheaded action. I forgot I was riding my bike. If you forget you're riding your bike, I drove into somebody else. Another bicyclist. Fortunately, I didn't knock them over. Just knocked myself over. But just completely airhead. I completely forgot what I was doing, which is like nobody should be out removing anything. It was a big wake-up call. I had been very, very, very conscientious, and then the last couple of weeks I noticed I was starting to get nervous. Just started letting my mind drift. I was writing this letter in my mind. I was having this conversation, I was writing this letter, and I just turned and just plowed right into somebody who was right in front of me in broad daylight. Thank God it wasn't a garbage truck. That's all I can say. Because it could have been. Okay. Now, all that I said before is fundamental to understanding the whole point of the chakras, because people talk about the chakras without understanding the context they come in, and without knowing the context, you can't utilize them as effectively. Okay? So what the chakras represent, the chakras are energy centers that are arrayed in the spine from the crown to the base of the spine. It's interesting when you think about it, that a person can exist all the way down from the base of the spine to the top of the head. You can have no limbs and you can have no legs. You can cut your legs off at the hips, you can cut your arms off at the shoulders, you can be essentially have the physiology of a worm, and you'll still be a total human being. You can function as a complete human being. But if you get any smaller than that, then you can't live. Because that is the fundamental, physically speaking, that is the fundamental bottom line of what it is to be human. Of course, it's inconvenient, but nonetheless, you can still live. And with all of the advances in warfare and medical technology, people are discovering how far they can be reduced. And it's not easy and it's not pleasurable, but it can still happen. And the reason it can happen is because from the top of the head to the base of the spine, this is where the chakras are located. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then the 7th chakra here. Okay? And so I'll just do it like this for now, and we'll fill this in. And I have a piece of paper in which various facts are written down. Now, there are many different ways to talk about the chakras, so I'm going to just give you one, you know, what from this perspective it looks like this, from this perspective it looks like that. All chakras are good. All chakras have a positive place in our lives and are necessary. You know, we can't live without the lower chakras, even though people will talk about the lower chakras are not good, the upper chakras are better, but you can't live without all of them. Because they also represent a complete assumption of the elements of material life. The chakras exist on levels beyond the physical, but Yogananda called the elements, assign the elements to the chakras, which everyone does. The first chakra is the earth, the second is water, the third is fire, the fourth is air. Ether is not like the gas that puts you to sleep, but it was a philosophical concept for many years where it just meant more subtle than air. And then he called it super ether, which was just trying to find words in English
that don't exist, for the spiritual life. Now, when the sperm and ovum come together, and Yogananda also has a secondary element here, which is related, which is the opposite pole of the sixth chakra. This is something he added. And this is the medulla right here. The medulla and the spiritual eye are the positive and negative pole of the same chakra. And what that means is, this is where the individual is identified with ego. And I'll explain ego in a minute. And this is where the soul is identified with spirit. And the entirety of spiritual life is to shift our identity from the medulla to the spiritual eye. Ego means to be identified with limitation. Okay? And another way of saying that is with the body, but it's the body, both material body and the energetic body. To be identified with anything other than the infinite. And to be identified with spirit, you're still an individual, but we recognize ourselves as part of a greater reality. To be identified with ego is to see ourselves primarily as separate. And if we think about it, identified with being primarily separate is the source of everything that makes us miserable. If I'm identified with my physical body, then whatever happens to my physical body is going to upset me. If I'm identified with my gender, with my unique personality, with my separate individual, then if you love me, I'm happy. If you don't love me, I'm unhappy. If my career flourishes, I'm happy. If my career doesn't flourish, I'm unhappy. If I have my money, I'm happy. If I lose my money, I'm not happy. If you're identified with spirit, which has no form and is infinite and is part of everything, whatever happens to this particular drop of the ocean, I'm never separated from the ocean. When I'm always separated from the ocean, trying to make it work for myself, this is where pleasure and ease get interrupted. So Yogananda writes that when the sperm and the ovum come together, it comes together at the medulla. This is the first cell in the body. And the first thing that happens is that the energy goes all the way down the birth chakra, because if I'm going to make a physical body, the power of spirit enters, and it goes all the way down to the earth chakra. And in your little picture of the developing fetus, the first thing that there's there, it looks like a potato stick. First thing that you can see, because it is just literally the pathway of the spine. And these energy centers are not physical by nature, and they're not perceivable by material means. They have to be perceived at a more subtle level, but the concentration of energy in these points then begins to manifest as the nerve centers and the point from which the whole body emanates. So the wisdom of the soul begins to manifest the body. And it has to come all the way down to the first chakra, because it has to reach the level of matter, or else it can't manifest the body. Or on a more subtle level, anyway, form. It has to take form. And if you eliminate the first chakra, you have no form, and then you have no life anymore. Now, that's one way of thinking about the chakras, which is that they're all essential, and all of these qualities have to work together in harmony with the spirit in order for us to have a life. Okay, the earth represents security, groundedness. Water represents creativity, flexibility. And fire represents willpower. Air represents love and love. Ether represents further expansion. And super ether represents bliss. Okay? Now, security, creativity, flexibility is another way to describe creativity. Security, flexibility, willpower, love, expansion, expression, this also means self-expression. All of these working together are what make a balanced human being. Isn't it so? I'll go into it in a little more strongly in just a moment. And so what we want is the energy, it's starting from the medulla, but it's guided by the spiritual eye. The energy circulates through all of these qualities, rises again like this, and this is actually Kundalini energy, however much of it we have. And when we live rightly, the guiding force is the spiritual eye, and then it gathers all of these qualities and expresses them in harmony with our highest understanding. If we're run more from the medulla than from the spiritual eye, we gather all of these qualities, and they're expressed from whatever understanding we have. Earth represents, let's start with security. And each of these qualities has a positive and a negative way of expressing. Security is a fundamental need of the human heart. Of course we need security, everyone does. You can't function unless you root it somewhere. But the question is, what gives us our security? Is our security from everybody tells me that I'm a good person? Is my security because you love me and have promised never to leave me and you will take care of me? Is my security the size of my bank account? Is security the fact that I belong to the right church and therefore my dogma is absolutely true and I am saved and you are not saved and therefore I feel secure? Or is our security an actual inner relationship with the greater reality that transcends everything else that comes to me? So when ease and pleasure are interrupted, where does security come from? I recently had a realization that I've been happy much of my life, but I've also been pleased much of my life. And when things happened that didn't please me, did I discover that I was really a happy person or just a person who'd usually been pleased? You know, where does my security come from? Does it come from the sure knowledge that God has taken care of me? Or does it come because with my willpower I've managed to arrange things in such a way that I'm not often threatened? We have to be secure for something, but we have to base our security on something more lasting than just you behaving the way I want you to behave. And the extent to which our security is based on unreliable sources, to that extent, the earth chakra is always a little rattled. Because even if it's holding it together, our soul knows that it's a little dicey what's going on. Okay? Creativity and flexibility, on the earth level, when you look at it in terms of elements, in form, on the material plane, everything is fixed. You know, this, you look at this pen and it's just a pen. It can't be anything else. We know scientifically now that this is an illusion, but on the level of the earth, everything is solid. So that's again why the earth element represents security, because it is that which apparently can't be changed. So we grab things that actually are unreliable, and then the economy changes, the government changes, the revolution changes, the earth changes, there's an earthquake and it's all lost. A friend of mine, her father, they were from South America, San Salvador, Nicaragua, right? They were so wealthy in Nicaragua that when whoever took over Nicaragua, the new dictator's palace was their home. So the family fled to Mexico, and then the father built it all up again. And then there was a fire, and he lost it all a second time. And he actually came to America and did it a third time, because he had lots of willpower, and he had lots of flexibility. And even though he kept bringing all of it into form, he had these other qualities that he could also use. He wasn't just dependent on where he was and what he got. Because the form, you know, it looks solid if it sticks. And if our security is based on the form holding, we're in trouble. So that's why we need the water element. The water element is creative and flexible. Oh, that didn't quite work. I think I'll try this. Oh, this isn't really quite making me happy. I think I'll try that. And you have water. He spilled that on the floor over there, and I don't know if it was water or what it is, but water in the glass looks like water. Looks like the glass. Water on the carpet looks like the carpet. You know, it's the same thing inside, but it can take whatever form is required. So the earth element has to be balanced by the capacity to take that energy and put it in a new form if it's needed. And if we're brittle, which is to say we don't have flexibility or creativity to respond, then our water element is weak. And we have to have both because
we have to.
And if we believe in God or in being part of a greater reality, we can have the flexibility to adjust with whatever reality comes to us. You know, divine reality is now expressing to me in a wholly different way. Now I'm poor and single and homeless. Whereas before I was, you know, married and secure and had a wonderful place to live. But was that my security or was my capacity to respond where it came from? Then the fire element is willpower. And willpower can take what is and transform it with energy. You know, fire can take this whole building, break all the form, just completely change it into something completely other, just a charred mass. A friend of mine recently had his entire house burned down. Everything burned down. Nothing. I mean, he was a keeper. He had everything in his whole life in his house. He evacuated not believing it was going to burn, and it burned. Absolutely burned. Everything was lost. I mean, just amazing. Fire has this amazing power to just... Another friend of mine, same fire up in Lake County, she had just moved from somewhere else. She had gotten everything she owned. She had unloaded it and put it into a storage locker. She had squoze it all in. She had shut the door, and a week later, it all burned down. Everything. The only thing that was saved was a stone statue, and somebody came and stole it. I mean, just like crazy. It's like it's time to go. Fire has that power. Now, if it's external and is dissolving the earth, changing our fixed form, that's one thing. But that same transforming power you see is ours. And it's the third chakra energy. And that, when things change and they have to be reformed, it's the fire, the power of fire, that gives us the capacity to do it. If our own qualities have to be reformed, if I'm recognizing that my attitudes are causing me grief, we need the fire chakra in order to change. We need the flexibility. We need to have our security based on something that we can hold on to, which is I have the power of the divine within me, and then we have to use our willpower to make it happen. This is, every chakra has its own, its right quality. Now, the earth chakra, positively expressed, gives us this unshakable loyalty to truth. The earth chakra, improperly expressed, makes us fanatical, narrow-minded, rigid, and often prejudiced, bigoted. These are the wrong qualities of the earth. But water chakra, creative flexibility, if it isn't grounded in the truth, so to speak, we just become wishy-washy. Oh, today I'll believe this, tomorrow I'll believe that, today I'll be married to this one, tomorrow I'll be married to that one, today I'll follow this path, tomorrow I'll follow this path, I love everybody just the same, well, is that really true? And we see people like that. They don't have any, they're not rooted to anything. So that which is positive can become negative. Fiery self-control is the positive expression of this. Self-directed positive energy. The negative is we use that fire against others. We become overbearing. If our security depends on everybody behaving in a certain way, then we use our firepower to keep them in line, which is how we break up our relationships and alienate our children and get fired from our jobs. We have lots of energy, but we're not using it in a way that starts with our own self. Instead, we just try to use it against others. And that's where then the heart chakra comes in, because the power of air is the beginning of our unity with others, isn't it? Air, it can actually be broken up into all these different forms, but once we sort of expand out that far, then all of a sudden our own aura begins to encompass others, and we begin to dissolve our separateness, use our willpower to dissolve our separateness, and we begin to be liberated in order to feel close, feel unity, association, cooperation in love. And then as that gets more subtle, it expands from the heart up into the throat, and then it really becomes even freer. This is what ether represents. Ether is the force behind even air. It's the unifying reality. That's what the philosophical meaning, the unifying reality in all of creation.
And it has to do with self-expansion and also communication. Because communication comes when we are able to unite, expand our own awareness into other people's awareness. You can talk without communicating. And this kind of expansiveness also, where you feel this great sense of unity, makes you very peaceful, because you're no longer this separate, identified with limitation. You're beginning to identify with the whole of reality, and so the threat is greatly diminished. The negative side of this quality is that you can become passive. The people, in the name of being non-attached, are often quite weak-willed and uncommitted. They don't really have a solid basis for their own nature, and so they'll play at being enlightened. But what they actually are is just low energy. There's not enough willpower or creativity to really participate. And our security comes from not being threatened. So you see, you have positive and negative. And then we expand up to the spiritual eye, which is all about the spiritual path. But the five chakras below are what we're dealing with first. Does that make sense? Any questions or comments about that before? It's written on a piece of paper. I'll give you to it. Okay. This is, I'm not finished. This is just a beginning point here. All right. So, now I'm going to take this off. Just to clear it here. Now, the other side of what these chakras represent, that's sort of like I'm saying we pick this up from different streams. The other side of what these chakras represent, from the first chakra up, is that we're also talking about different concepts of what is reality. Okay. So the first chakra, being earth, it, in this way of talking about it now, represents that the material world. The apparent fixed reality that I see, my separate identity from that greater reality, is what's true. And whenever we make a decision about what's going to cause us suffering and what's going to make us happy, we are affirming, whenever we make a decision, whenever we have a thought, whenever we have an attitude, we have an emotional reaction, everything that we do in life affirms some level of reality from pure matter to pure spirit. Okay? When Jesus was being crucified, he looked at those who were crucifying him and he said, "Father, forgive them. They know not what they do." He looked at these people who were doing a very bad thing, and he knew they were doing a bad thing, and the karma for doing that bad thing was not going to be good for them. But his thought, even as he's being crucified, is to offer a prayer of intercession. And what he was actually saying is, "Oh, please, don't make them suffer for the mistake they're making." Because his consciousness was completely identified with spirit. He was as much in their bodies as he was in his own. He was not ego-identified. Ego is identified with the body, either the physical. And the body would say, "My body is being crucified and yours is down on the ground." But he was identified entirely with spirit, and so he was as much concerned for their well-being as his own. If he'd been identified with matter, he would have been enraged, because I'm being hurt and you're hurting me. So every time we make a decision, as I say, or any reaction, we're making an affirmation, we're making a statement of what I think is real, where I think my happiness comes from, who do I think I am, on the spectrum from pure matter to pure spirit. I can talk a very good philosophy, but if I'm in the car and it looks for a second like somebody's going to run into me and I panic over that happening, that is an affirmation of the fact that I am identified with my body. My body looks like it's going to be threatened. I fear the pain and the accident that's about to come. And quite apart from what my ideas about myself are, in that moment, who I really am
what I really believe to be true. And now I may recover, but not necessarily quickly. When I was, this was now many years ago, but we had the bad earthquake here in 1989, and the building I was in began to shake. Some of my friends afterwards said, oh, they immediately, their thoughts just went to God and so on like that. Mine didn't. Mine went to, oh my, mine went to God, but more like, oh my God! And I went running outside. I didn't just surrender to God in that 1 second. I panicked. I ran out of the building. I wasn't proud of it, but that's where my consciousness went. I couldn't pretend in that moment. It just, whatever I was is what happened. If somebody says something unkind to you and you snap back at them, you know, you might wish that your energy was in the heart chakra all the time, but you're now using your willpower to affirm your separateness. Okay? And this is metaphysics. This is where the word comes from, metaphysics. This is not my opinion. This is not God's will. This is not whether you're a Catholic or a Jew. This is nothing. This is metaphysics. These are vibrations of consciousness, vibrations of reality from fixed matter to free spirit, and we just fall like on a piano, just somewhere on that spectrum. Now, each of these chakras, in the way I'm talking about it now, represents a vibration of consciousness somewhere on the spectrum from pure matter to pure spirit. And if we could give it a number, and actually people do. I mean, they take this metaphysics really exactly. They give it colors and numbers and sounds, and it's all true. It's all happening. Every time, and what a chakra is, the word chakra means wheel. And these are not fixed realities. These are spinning vortices of energy. And the word chakras, because you can see them, which I can't, but some people can, what you see a spinning field of energy, which has both sound and color and light in relationship to what vibration it represents. And these spinning fields of energy are constantly being, are objects in motion. They're not physical, they're constantly forming and reforming. They're not just fixed and set. They're just fields of energy. If you think of it like a river. I spoke before of the energy flow that goes like this. This is the river. And if you think of each of these as whirlpools, just literally think of a physical river. The river is flowing like this, and it's been drawn into whirlpools. So the energy that's heading for the sea is hanging out for a long time in these whirlpools like this. And those whirlpools, though, constantly change. Something falls into it, something becomes dislodged, the river goes into flood, and some of those whirlpools were drawn in, the river slows down, and more is drawn into this. It's not, I mean, I particularly love rivers, and I love watching water. I can just watch water endlessly. I was somewhere where there were these big waterfalls, and I was just watching the waterfall, and it's so incredible, because it's never the same water. It just keeps always changing. That's exactly what's going on here. And you watch the pattern constantly shifting because every thought, every action, every feeling that you have is a vibration of energy that doesn't go away. Because we are ego identified with the energy that flows through us, it stays with us. Our ego is our individual self is identified with these energy patterns. I am a person who loves chocolate. I am a person who can't stand men who are over 6'4". I am a person who loves opera. I am a person who's afraid of the dark. I am a person who's very insecure because my mother was an alcoholic. We have all of these self-definitions. We are ego-identified, and so these patterns of energy hang around us because we ourselves hold on to them. You know, it's the most fascinating thing because all that happened to us in the past, it doesn't exist anymore. It's completely gone. All the lives that we lived before, they're completely gone. They're nowhere. They're not happening now. A friend of mine, when she died of cancer, and she knew she was dying, and she was very conscious and cooperative in the process. There was no part of her that was trying to duck.
And at the very end of her life, she was lying in her bed, and a friend of mine was visiting her, and she said to the friend, she said, I'm lying here, and she said, I'm seeing thousands of faces passing before me, and every one of them was my own face in one of my earlier incarnations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she said, and I'm finding it very hard to be attached to the one I'm wearing now, because she was just seeing it in the context of all of this. It's just all, it's all coming, it's all going away. What holds it is that we're identified with it. I feel it in my own heart. Present relationships that I know are influenced from past life experiences. Present unresolved relationships influenced by past life experiences. I brought it to an amusing conclusion, a poignant and amusing conclusion, when I thought to myself, somebody owes me an apology. And I realized I was just carrying around from events, God knows when, that somebody owes me an apology. And I have not let go of the fact that somebody, and that body isn't even a body anymore. The individual who used to inhabit that body, me, is still here. The individuals who inhabited the bodies that I think owe me an apology are still here. But the reason it's still going on is because I'm identified with it. There's a center point of magnetism. And so all of this energy keeps swirling around. The specifics, I don't remember. But the vibration, I remember. Somebody did me wrong and owes me an apology. Now, that's a definition of reality, isn't it? Somewhere between matter is the only reality and spirit is the only reality. I mean, Jesus didn't think those people owed him an apology. Jesus just thought, oh, these poor souls, they're making such a mistake. God forgive them. Right. When the people that I was still mad at, I wasn't thinking, oh, these poor souls, they're making a mistake. God take care of them. I was thinking, you did this to me, and you have to make it right with me. Now, I mean, we can find that in our present memory, and why would it not be true in what is no longer active to our awareness, but is still vibrating in our hearts? So every single time we do anything, we add energy at whatever chakra it that action actually reflects. And this is where Art was saying, wow, this can take us a long time, can't it? And in fact, it does take us a long time. But once you become aware of the metaphysics of this, you bring into play powerful forces that are greater than just your own personality struggling to learn, lamely struggling to learn its own lessons. Okay, now, questions or comments or thoughts before I go into other parts of this? He's all staring at it. I know my little marvelous drawings up there is trying to sort it out. Okay.
I do have a question. Uh-huh. When you incarnate again,
right,
how much of this will transfer?
Absolutely every iota of it. Okay. The chakras are not physical. The chakras are an energy pattern. As individual, the actual Sanskrit word for it is jiva, which is roughly equivalent to the word soul. But jiva is more accurate. Jiva is that impersonal spark of individuality which is eternal. It is the bubble. This is the bubble that merges into the ocean eventually. From the beginning of your manifestation from the spirit, you have an individual jiva, which is the animating force in all of your incarnations. It's just a slightly more accurate word. So the jiva has three basic realities. It's called the causal, the astral, and the material. And they are like, if you want to think about it, they're like three concentric realities, like this. And the causal is the level of thought. The astral is the level of energy. And the material is the level of matter. Physical is the level of matter. Okay?
idea is also a good idea. Everything in creation follows these three patterns. If you think about it, before anything can be manifested, somebody has to have the idea to do it, somebody has to apply energy to that idea, and then finally it materializes. If you want to build a house, you have to have the idea to build the house, you have to put out the energy to design it, and then put the materials together, and then finally you'll have a material manifestation. Because these are the three stages of creation. For the jiva exists simultaneously in all three. This is the heart of it is the causal, then there's the astral, and then the physical. And so, and they all exist, they all exist simultaneously like this, because the idea of who we are always has to be there. And then there's the energy, and then there's the physical manifestation. When the physical body dies, and that outer ring is taken away, our individuality is not dissolved, because the energy that we put into our incarnation and the idea of who we are is still completely intact. And what happens then is we just put out the energy, we get the idea, we put out the energy, and we manifest another physical body. And then we live through that. And then when that one dies, the energy is withdrawn. But we, our individuality, the ocean still exists all around it, and we're still encased in our bubble. So the chakra system exists on the astral level. It's not physical in any way. I know someone had a hysterectomy, and they wrote to me, and they had been told their second chakra had been removed. No, I said that would be quite a surgeon. You no longer have a womb, but you really have a second chakra. Because the whole body can die. And then what happens is you exist in an energy form. And that energy form, just like the movies show us now, that energy form very closely resembles the physical form, because the physical form is the manifestation of the energy blueprint. So it just goes back to blueprint form, but it's not like passive. It's not like a paper blueprint. It's the vibrating energy of who we are. So who you are is not the physical body you've made, the face you have, the experiences you've had. Who you are is the collective vibration of your state of consciousness based on that spectrum. Let me think about it for a minute. I lived for a long time with Swami Kriyananda very closely. He vibrated so at such a fine, refined spiritual level that just who he was, he manifested through that body, but who he was this completely other vibration. He existed through all his chakras, he expressed, he experienced, but the sum total of his chakras was this refined magnetism on a level that was just like nothing, like nobody else I knew. Completely different, even though he walked around and he joked and I served him breakfast and, you know, just all of these different energies. But the collective vibration was something completely other. And, you know, he would go through different experiences and do different things. But like one of my friends remarked, he never changed his vibration. And we know with ourselves, if you think about the people you know, some people have very nice vibrations. Some people have really refined vibrations. Some have really icky vibrations. Some people have very mixed vibrations. They can have very, like, have a very strong, loving, marvelous, loving heart, but like no ability to express it. Or they might be marvelously just creative and flexible, but they really just don't really care about anybody. Because you're just a collection of all these different pieces. And what we're gradually trying to do is to get all of these to be appropriately balanced. That doesn't mean that every jiva becomes exactly the same. It's just that the energy flows nicely through all of them and makes us exactly the sum total of who we're supposed to be, all guided from the wisdom of spirit. So when the physical body dies, which is your chakras are who you are. So the physical body falls away and the chakras just go on. The jiva continues to wear a body, and that body is an astral body. Just like I'm wearing this, and I can change into something else, but I'm still clearly me, and what I wear is related to the shape an inclination of the jiva. So I put on a physical body that relates to the inclination of the jiva, and then I take it off. But the blueprint of who I am remains here. Now, what you may need in terms of a physical body can vary greatly depending on what you have to learn. Because the energy builds up in the chakras. Let's say I have a great deal of flexibility, but I don't really care about anyone. So I'm imbalanced. I don't know how to love. I know how to make art, but I don't know how to love someone. I know how to be sexual, but I don't really know how to communicate what I really feel. I know how to make a lot of money, you know, but my heart is just tiny. Mm-hmm. So what happens is the jiva, guided by spirit, whether we're conscious or not, recognizes where the imbalances are. And another way of saying it is where the karma is, where the unlearned lessons are, where the mistakes are being made. And so it will create, it will be drawn to create a physical body. The sperm and the ovum will come together in what Master calls a flash of light in the astral world. And you'll come into a womb that's going to allow you to identify with a body that will give you the experiences you need to start bringing these chakras into balance. And so absolutely everything that happens to you is determined by the magnetic vibrations in your chakras. And it comes to you because it's metaphysics. Because the jiva needs to understand, needs to get into a truer and clearer and more conscious relationship to Satchitananda, to eternal realities. So whatever imbalances are there, you will magnetize to yourself exactly what you need to fix those imbalances. And will it always be easy and pleasurable? Not likely. It will often be quite jarring and quite distressing because real shifts of energy are needed. And then how we respond, not what happens to us. Because what happens to us, it's already set in motion. And there's just nothing you can do. You can lament. That's where the phrase, it seemed like a good idea at the time, has always been such a good friend of mine. Because you can lament all you like. How did I ever get into this? How did I get so addicted to alcohol? How did I get so far in debt? Why did I ever marry this person? Whoever thought I should have children? What a stupid idea it was. Why didn't I stay in Hawaii when I could have? You know, just whatever the words might be. You can't really stop that because it's done. The pattern is there. But how you respond will determine what the pattern becomes and therefore what happens next. So if, for example, you have a weakness for greed and easy money no matter what, how it affects others is something that you're really inclined to do. And well, what do you know? You're the executor of your mother's will, and all you have to do is just get her to sign this little piece of paper and 2/3 goes to me. And so you do that because you have a strong sense of, I need money. Or maybe you're just mean and you want to get back at so-and-so. So-and-so owes me an apology and I'm really going to show them. So you respond. Now you're the person who's lost your inheritance because your evil brother has taken it away from you, let's say, as an example. So how do I respond? Now, it doesn't necessarily mean you should be a doormat, because maybe this evil brother play all of the qualities that need to be brought into play. And yours is truly, it's all right, I took lots of money from lots of people in past lives and it's time for me to lose it. And you really know that. And that is your genuine response. I don't need to punish him. Let God sort it out in future lifetimes. This is just the right thing that has to happen. You may take that. If it's fiery willpower that's required, you just take this person to court and you never give up until you get everything that belongs to you. But it's guided by spirit. It's not guided by malice. So it's not what happens to us, it's how we respond according to how can we move everything into a higher vibration. Does that make sense? And until we do, until we learn to govern all of these qualities, earth, water, fire, air, from the point of view of how can I draw closer to a greater reality, become more part of a greater reality, until all of our chakras are run from the spiritual eye, not just from the ego. We just keep reincarnating. This is what karma is. Karma is the extent to which I identify with something other than my infinite self. Yes, sir.
Where does unfulfilled desire fit in this?
Okay, I am unhappy because I don't have. I really need. I so wish I had. I wished I could have had children. I wish I didn't have children. I wish I could have married this other person. I wish I didn't become a banker. Why didn't I just go to art school? Okay, all of those ideas. Here's this ego is identified with, this is what I need to make me happy. And then we build all this construct about it. If so-and-so would just apologize to me, I'll be happy. So I'm going to marry them this time and spend all of my incarnation trying to get them to apologize to me. I mean, people do this all the time, don't they? And this is completely unreasonable. You have this completely insane, incomprehensible reaction, but because you had this idea that this is what I really needed to be happy, and I built up all this energy around it. Now, does that make sense? Get anything that you're identified with that conditions your happiness other than surrender to God creates the word is vritti. Vritti means whirlpool. It creates a vritti in your chakra. And whatever is at the center of it, I need people to apologize to me to be happy. Now, you can go around for many incarnations, which we do, trying to accumulate these apologies. And you get so-and-so to apologize, and you finally get that one settled, but so-and-so was pretty mean to me this time, so now I have to get this one to apologize. And then after I get that one to apologize, then this one over here is mad at me. So incarnation after incarnation, we work on this essential idea that people done me wrong and they have to apologize. But at some point, we might realize, wait a minute, nobody ever did anything to me. They all just gave me the experiences I needed in order to become free. So if you can dissolve the essential point, which is holding all this energy together, the whole vritti can go away.
So is that the forgiveness piece?
Forgiveness is a word that is okay. And yes, the answer to that is yes. I prefer the word acceptance of reality. Because forgiveness still implies that I'm right. But now that I have advanced so much, I'm no longer going to hold you responsible. There's a little something in there. I know forgiveness is very powerful. To me, it makes me nervous, because whenever I'm forgiving someone, I always feel like I'm making a different routine. Acceptance of reality says, you know, did the best you could.